Hey y'all, Anita here. We were just at XOXO, an arts and tech festival full of your favorite internet creators, and I sat down with a few of my favorites to learn more about their work and what drives them, and I wanted to share those conversations with you. So, we're going to release a few bonus episodes in the coming weeks with conversations with people like Lucy Bellwood and Natalie Wynn from ContraPoints. We recorded in this really neat Airstream trailer camped out on the festival grounds, so big thanks to all those folks who volunteered their time and resources to make audio recording more accessible. You can learn more about them at streampdx.com. Oh, and one last thing. Remember, we need your help to keep making this podcast, so please consider joining our podcast community for exclusive perks and bonus content at d.rip/femfreak. I hope you enjoy these interviews. Hello, Lucy Bellwood.
Hi, Anita Sarkeesian.
We are here at XOXO 2019, 18? It's not 19 yet.
It's 2018. A big fuck up. That was scary.
That was scary, wasn't it? You know, I will say that I've been sitting in this beautiful Airstream that is fucking cool, but hot as shit.
Fucking cool, but hot as shit is
exactly.
A great catchphrase for XO 2019.
I will let them know.
Yeah.
I will suggest it. No, I'm so stoked to have you here. You do cool shit, and I want everyone to know about it. You describe yourself as an adventure cartoonist.
That is correct.
You are the only one in the world.
That is untrue.
Really?
Yes.
Have other people adopted this term?
I think there are other people who did it before I came along and just didn't use the title, but there are absolutely... I don't want to call them disciples because that's a little like culty, but there are people who have seen it and been like, oh, that's what I want to do. And now they do that thing also. But for like long distance through hiking for, you know, the Pacific Crest Trail or like science communication in the Antarctic or.
Rad.
Yeah. There's like a huge field of people who are doing nonfiction comics work in various environments that are not at a drawing table all the time.
Yeah.
But it's nice to have a catchphrase for it.
Can you describe what that means to you and how it describes your work?
Yeah. Mostly it means that I don't like sitting still. And usually making comics is a very solitary affair where you like go and hang out in a room by yourself and have massive social anxiety and like then occasionally come out to sign books at conventions and feel nervous and then go back in your hole. And that is true of me some of the time. But a lot of the time, I grew up in a really outdoorsy background. And so I really like being in the world and in the wilderness. And I like being enthusiastic about things and sharing that enthusiasm with other people. So a lot of the time, my work involves telling stories about places I've been and things I've done. And it's a little tricky to talk about it now because the book that I just had come out is about imposter syndrome and doesn't really have anything to do with adventures unless they are adventures of the human spirit.
Nice save.
Of the soul. Yeah, I've been trying to spin this for many months now. I'm like, how do I segue here?
No, that was excellent.
Internal and external adventures.
Yeah. Well, so I recently you just went on a big tour for your book 100 Demon Dialogues, and I got to come out to that. And so the book is you taking 100 days of doing a thing about imposter syndrome every day.
Yeah,
you drew a panel,
a little 6x6 single panel comic.
Yeah.
Every day.
And turned it into a book.
Unexpectedly, yes.
And made the best plushie.
It's so soft, right?
It's a little demon. And I actually, I've been like, I need to stop spending money. I shouldn't buy things. I fucking have too many goddamn plushies. You spent so much time making this plushie perfect so that it sits really nice.
Yeah.
And it's on my desk. And I kind of feel like it's this really nice reminder of like it's this weird thing, right? Because it represents your inner demons, this
right
is your
which
point.
Is everything awful about
right
you,
but it like it's so cute and it yeah just sits there, and so it's this weird like reminder, but like combat your demons. I don't know how to make sense of the fact that I love having it on my desk.
Yeah, I think that's true. I didn't really know how to make sense of the fact that towards the end of the project people were like writing me comments wondering if I was going to kill him off on day 100 or, you know, I was going to off him like before then. And people got really invested. And it was strange because in one breath they'd be saying like, oh, that guy is such an asshole. I totally know that little voice. It tells me I'm garbage all the time. And then by the other breath they'd be saying like, oh, but he's so cute.
Right.
Like, oh, he just wants a hug.
Yeah.
And so you needed something that had limbs that were flaily enough that if you threw them down the stairs, they would windmill in a very satisfying manner. Which they do.
That's your criteria.
Yeah,
cool,
absolutely. Because
cool.
We talked about putting wire in the limbs so that it would be poseable. But I actually really think the wobbly legs are important. You need like Kermit Arms Demon. And then the other criteria is that it would be soft and cuddly and like the size of, if not a child, like something. I didn't want it to be too small and I didn't want it to be too big. And
it is not the size of a child, just in case really? Anyone is wondering.
Aren't babies kind of that big? I guess they're a little bigger.
No, they're
it's maybe the size of bigger than the that. Size of half a baby.
It's a yes. Half of a like newborn. 2 weeks old. I don't know.
Not
it's,
endorsing chopping your newborn in half.
Are you sure you're not?
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, that might be illegal in a lot of
everywhere.
Both morally and
a lot of everywhere.
Yeah, a lot of everywhere. But one of the things that I really appreciated was on your tour, you found local creatives to have a dialogue with about imposter syndrome. And I hadn't seen the comic, but I bought it when I stopped in. And then I just like read it that night. I mean, it's a fast read.
Yeah,
but
that's the great thing about comics, right? You spend a year slaving over the... No, this yeah. this was like 3.5 months because it was just one yeah. thing a day for 100 days. But it's great that that can turn into a book and then you can hand it to someone and they can get what you're talking about. Really, like the gist of the book comes across in maybe one or two entries. You know,
yeah.
you could like open it to any spot.
But then it's
and get
kind
it.
Of addictive because
it is.
You're like, it's such an interesting, it's so not universal, but like, it, for anyone who has done creative work, you're like, oh, I've heard this.
Yeah.
My little demon has told me this. And having you show that in a way I think is really powerful for folks because they feel less alone.
Mm-hmm.
And even if we know that it exists, like being able to articulate some of the more nuanced ways that that comes across, I think is
yes.
is really powerful for folks.
And there's something about looking at a thing every day for 100 days that means you kind of have to move beyond just the knee-jerk reaction to something. It's actually listening to another person, right? Even if that other person is a part of yourself.
Yeah.
And you move beyond the knee-jerk of like, well, this is bad and you're bad. And then you're like, okay, why are you feeling that way? You kind of play therapist to yourself. And
yeah.
it's actually, there is a form of therapy that is basically the process outlined in this book. It's called acceptance and commitment therapy, where you divorce your negative ideation from your sense of self and you create a character for it and you have a dialogue with it and you like approach it with tenderness and listening and like loving kindness instead of antagonism and like this is my enemy. And it's a little of both because the voice it contradicts itself all the time. So it'll say you're not working hard enough or you shouldn't do anything today. You should just stay in bed.
Yeah. Like,
you can't accomplish your goals, so why even try? And it's tricky because once you start listening to it over time, you're like, well, pick a lane, guy. Like, which one is it? Do you think I should work all the time or do you think I'm not capable of doing anything? Like, it becomes apparent that there are holes in the logic.
Yeah. How did you grapple or did you grapple at all with the vulnerability of doing this so publicly and committing to like, I need to share this scary voice every day with the world? Like, we don't usually talk about this stuff publicly for the most part, right?
I think
sometimes we don't even acknowledge it within ourselves.
Yeah. And that is a part that is really interesting is like, there are some ways in which I became bolder as the project went on, although someone pointed, or maybe I noticed this when I was mentioning like which entries were really actually very hard for me, because I'm a fairly gushy, open person to begin with. And I think attending events like XOXO has actually really impacted that, because I spoke here in 2016 and gave a talk that was kind of out of necessity and panic, a version of this project where I got up on stage and was like, listen, I had my first book come out this year. I got an agent. I went on tour. All these things that people tell me are really successful. And I'm on food stamps. And I don't know how to communicate that to my friends. I do still feel successful. But what they think of as success is like limousines and money and like not having to worry about rent. And that's not the reality. And the reception to that talk really kicked off my desire to do a book that was about this stuff. And I think opening up like that on stage in front of 800 people and having them not throw rocks at me was a really, my bar was pretty low. they also, nice things happen, right? People hugged me and we talked about, you know, both being on food stamps and like, and then people from positions of greater privilege too were like, I had no idea. I didn't know that most cartoonists are making it work on $20,000 a year. Like, that seems impossible. And I'm like, it is.
Yeah.
It turns out.
It is. So this brings up a whole, I wish we had hours to talk.
I know.
Because this brings up a whole host of things about what success is and what success looks like, and especially what is perceived as success.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned this with a quickness.
Yes.
Because two things, and I've seen this in other people since then. I had a successful Kickstarter. I'm using air quotes. It was, but I'm not saying it wasn't. It was absolutely, it was
successful by certain markers, right?
But that somehow the success of that Kickstarter therefore meant that I was fine for the rest of my life.
Right. Or that you don't deserve like compassion or human kindness. Like there's a weird thing that people say.
Yeah.
There's another thing about like, oh, you're famous, so like you don't deserve to ask for it. It's the you're a celebrity, why are you using Kickstarter model, which is
A whole other thing. But the other part is that like if you are in the media or have a profile or a following at all, right? Like and I notice this a lot with like if you're interviewed for articles, if you become an expert, like an expert speaker at a thing, it's just assumed that you are financially stable.
Right.
But like it literally being interviewed for an article in the New York Times means literally nothing about your finances.
Absolutely true.
And that perception is so tough to deal with, especially as we become more I feel like an old curmudgeonly person because I'm like as we become more accessible to people because of social media, right? Like it's like it's been that way for a while, but
yeah, but like it is changing, I think. There are a lot of things that we are figuring out the rules for as we go. And it is weird to look at the current landscape and think like, oh, I'm an early adopter on some of these platforms, or like I am, people look up to me because I was here for the start of this thing, which was only 5 years ago. Like it moves so fast.
Yeah.
And all of that is like, it's really hard to grapple with when you're trying to keep your head on straight and figure out what to take from people who have done stuff like this before. Because we don't have to reinvent the wheel every time.
Right.
Right. We can learn from other fields. We can learn from each other. But there are also some new parameters at play in terms of like what people, the parasocial relationships we develop with people online. And we think that we know them. And you can never really know the entirety of somebody's story. Like I tried on the subject of being interviewed for the New York Times or like having a big high profile thing. I had an image, an illustration that went viral and I wrote an essay about how much money I'd made as a result of that because it was shared on Boing Boing, a site that gets millions and billions of hits a year. And it was picked up by the whole roster of like viral cool thing websites. So My Modern Met, Atlas Obscura, like the persona people like George Takei and Chris Hadfield, like the folks who make a lot of money sharing cool stuff on the internet. And millions of people saw that image and I netted probably about $800.
Wow.
Because the person who blogged about it for Boing Boing, Rusty Blazenhoff, who was a professional, had bothered to link to my store where people could buy that image on a print or whatever. And it was actually an illustration I'd done when I was a baby just starting out for like, I don't know, I think I got paid $150. It was an illustration for a museum exhibit. And over, since 2013 when I drew it, I've made maybe $1,200 off the artwork, including merchandising and other right. stuff and whatever. And that essay got a lot of traction because people were like, look, a lot of folks jump straight to the conclusion of, see, fame doesn't pay and like viral attention means nothing. But then there's the flip side of like, yeah, okay, maybe not all those people went and bought a print, but some percentage of those people, if they encounter my work again, will be like, wait a minute, that's that lady who did that thing. Oh, she has a Patreon. Oh, maybe I should support her. You know, like that.
Yeah.
It's so hard to measure the metrics. But you get scared. I don't know about you, but I get scared of people thinking I'm successful because I feel like if they think I'm successful, they're going to stop believing that they can make a difference in my fiscal viability as an artist.
100%.
And they can still very much
right.
so.
That whole like kicking in $5 to a Patreon makes big fucking difference.
So hardcore.
So, you know, hey, drip backers.
Hey, what's
back,
up?
Back this podcast. Back Lucy's Patreon. It all helps. It all matters. And then the other thing is, I think this is related to the fact that like when I first started, it was a lot easier to get like attention for your work and get it out there. And it's not anymore. It is so highly saturated. And crowdfunding is a part of our creative ecosystem. And I fucking love crowdfunding.
Yeah.
It is the most, to me, one of the most ethical ways of raising money. But it is also so saturated that it's hard to even be successful in that way anymore.
And like it's also hard to be considered an expert on something or like a thought leader or whatever. I don't know. All of these terms sound really bloated, but like a person that people say like, oh, here's someone who's good at Kickstarter or good at Patreon or good at social media. And yes, sure, I do a lot of those things in my career, but, and I think and talk about them a lot, but also I started on Twitter 10 years ago, you know, mm-hmm. on like Kickstarter in 2012, like at times when the ecosystem was really different. And
I know when people are like, how do I do this now? I'm like, oh, I wouldn't be able to do this now.
Once you've gone through the door, like the walkway is collapsing behind you at all times when you're making things online.
And in front of me. Like it really feels like that, right?
On all sides. Just in the middle of a burning building.
I have a vague memory of being at a conference with you. I think it was you. And you were talking about the tension between having put so much of yourself out there and your fans expecting a certain level of intimacy and attention from you and not really wanting to do that anymore or wanting to be careful about that.
I've been to a lot of conferences where that has been a commonality. It may very well have been me, but it also may very well have been like a number of other people that I follow. Because there are a lot of us, I think, especially like female coded folks, who are seeing success building these like relatable, personal, accessible online characters. And people hit a point where, and there are folks speaking at the lineup at the festival this weekend, I think, who are going to really address that and exemplify it in their work and their behavior, who have had to hit a point of saying, like, you know what, this is my day job. This is the character I play for my day job. And then when I come home at night, I do something just for me. And it's become really difficult when, like, your job is dependent on a platform that is designed from jump to be addictive like a drug. And that's your job. You can't, like, all these books that are coming out right now that are like 10 reasons why you should quit social media right now, or like how to break up with your phone. And they're good books, probably.
Yeah, but not, I mean, so many of us, our entire careers are predicated on social media.
Yeah, my job would not exist without the internet.
No.
And I don't want to be on the internet all the time. Especially, I mean, that's like part of the adventure cartoonist thing is like, I go in the wilderness because like at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, no one can check their email. And I can put on an autoresponder and be like, leave me alone. I'm drawing comics.
Yeah, right.
Remember that part of my job that I only spend like 5% of my time doing because the rest of it is managing. I mean, yeah. Do you have like an assistant or a person who helps you with scheduling or social media or like logistics stuff?
So we have an officer, a director who actually our podcast listeners know because she is named Ebony and she's Delight on our podcast.
So the three
of us, Carolyn, Ebony, and I all are like the core people who run Feminist Frequency.
Right.
So we all have different roles. But yeah, I remember when I was running Femme Freak alone and just like my entire day was just emails.
Yeah.
Like just going through our inbox. And also I never replied to things because I just didn't have the time to.
No, you managed to read it and then you're like, cool, now I'm going to feel bad about this.
Barely read it, right? Like loads of people wrote lovely things and I was like, I'm sorry, I can't respond to all of this shit.
Yeah.
So, or like requests all got buried. It was just like all kinds of stuff. And so it's when you hit a certain, it could just be like one of your pieces of art hit like a zeitgeist moment.
Right.
And then all of a sudden you're like bombarded with, I keep doing that. All of a sudden you're bombarded with requests and you can't keep up with it.
Yeah. So like, and it's like then people say, oh, you're such a jerk. You never reply to my email. And like most of the time, I mean, this backfires because it means that I am like unwilling to email anyone that I admire because I assume they're in a similar situation where all the email they get, they're like, I can't fucking deal with this. And so it's stopped me a lot of times from reaching out to people who would actually be, again, hard to say this without sounding like egotistical, they would be happy to hear from me because I'm not like a spammer trying to get their contact information, or I'm not like a person writing to tell them why their head is weirdly shaped from a YouTube video that they saw. You know, there's like a lot of garbage that people have to sift through.
Or also like there are these moments where like, this is a hard conversation to have where the public can hear it, like for what I'm about to say, because like being asked to do 1,000 interviews a week,
mm-hmm.
is exhausting.
Yeah.
And like I used to say no to everything and then I said yes to everything and now I'm trying to figure out what the fuck I'm doing, because it's like when I'm in, like I might be in a documentary that comes out and it's a big documentary, it's a big exciting thing. I didn't get paid for that.
Right.
And I spent days and days and days with them, right? So like it's a matter of like how do you manage your time versus the exposure you get,
mm-hmm.
and also you can't pay people with exposure at a certain point, right?
And there are seasons when that is appropriate, right? When you have a new project coming out, like there's a reason that I'm committing to touring for most of this year, is that doing all of these like, you know, self-organized tour things and pitching outlets and doing all this stuff is in aid of getting my book out and like connecting with people. And that was a big part of the importance of the project for me, was making sure that other people knew that this thing existed so they could feel less alone along with me. And that has been really worth it for me, but I'm starting to hit my limit of, you know, like you go on 6 months of that and it's like, okay, I'd really love to just be left alone. I don't even remember what I do when I'm left alone. Like that's the other question.
I know that feeling.
Is you become so good at giving interviews that then the demon starts to say like, well, maybe this is all you're good at. You know, you don't remember how to make art. Like all you can do is give a nice sound bite and you have this rehearsed thing. And the other challenge is that a lot of interviews are kind of the same thing. And so it's so refreshing if somebody sits you down and they're like, I don't actually want to talk about this project.
Yeah, let's talk about something totally
different. Yeah, let's talk
about, which is not going to happen usually, but
yeah.
I find that like I'm on the road a lot and I come home and I can't function. Like I'm so exhausted because when I'm on the road, whether I'm surrounded by people or not, it's full travel work mode.
Yes.
And I come home and I'm on my couch with my cat and I'm watching TV and I'm like, I can't function. I can't answer these emails. I can't do anything.
Which has been piling up while you've been on the road.
Exactly. Because you're doing the other work, not the work that's the sit at your desk work.
Yep.
And that demon in my head is always like, you're useless. Like you're lazy. Not like ass and do something. And when it really should be like, you should take a couple days and rest.
This is the season for resting now.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's that. I feel like there was a lot of what I really appreciate in the book is like a lot of that tension I noticed in some of the ways that you talked about it, where I'm like, yes, there's actually, I wish I had brought it up because there's one panel that I was like reading it in the office and I was like, yes, yes. And like everyone looked at me like, what is wrong with you right now? I was like, this is my life right here in this one panel.
Do you remember which one it was?
No, I gotta find it. Okay. And
I'd be curious to hear.
Yeah, it was very early on. And there was a part of me that was like, can I just get a print of this and put it on the wall?
Yep.
And but it's this weird thing. Yeah, you're like, yes,
you can. They're all in my store. You can get prints of whatever one you want.
Oh, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Print on demand. It's the best.
Oh, that's great. I might do that. But then there's a part of me that's like, again, this is exactly what we started with of like the plushie. It's like, do you want to be reminded of this thing that doesn't feel good? Or do you want to be reminded of it to remind you that it's not real? Like,
yeah,
it's not that it's not real. It's, I think one of the things that was so interesting that you were talking about where it's like, well, are you going to kill off the demon?
Mm-hmm.
Like, but I don't think it's about killing it off. I think it's about like recognizing its existence and living in some kind of synergy, like the back and forth of it. Right.
Yeah.
In therapy, we talk a lot about how like it's not linear.
Nope.
You go up and down. I fucking hate it. I hate that it's not linear.
If you're a very progress-oriented type A person, it's like, what do you mean it's not like that?
Yeah, it's like, I'm doing all of this work. Can it be I did the work. Why are we regressing? But that's what that is, right? It's like, it's not going to go away. So I like that it's cute, and I like that it's this charming, annoying thing, because it's there. It's not going away. It's how do you live with it and acknowledge it?
Right. And so many of the books that we read, especially in this culture, in American culture, are like how to eradicate your inner demon, how to never have another negative thought. Like if you buy this book, if you follow this edict, if you get rid of all your possessions, if you do that, you're never going to feel bad again. And that's just not true. Like feeling bad is part of being human. And there was a line in Cameron Esposito's keynote last night that I was just like just frantically scrawling down, that we have to see the hurt before we can apply the balm.
I love
and
that.
And I was just like, yeah, girl!
I love
so
that.
Into it.
So several years ago, I went on this huge kick where I read a lot of therapy books.
Mm-hmm.
Like because I think you were talking about being type A personalities. I was going through some stuff and I was like, I'm going to read about everything about psychology.
If I know about it, it won't cause me problems anymore.
Which isn't
Hello,
true.
Liberal arts college.
Yeah, exactly. One of the books that I read talked about how like your emotions, it's not about just being happy and all the time. It's that each of your emotions give you different kinds of information.
Yes.
And so like when you are angry, that part of that is boundary violation. Like, and being able to just sit with feelings, which is one of the hardest things to do, but like it makes such a big difference. But like we're never taught these skills. We pay thousands of dollars in therapy to like maybe be told these things.
Right.
And if you're even open to hearing them at the time, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that's a part of this that like how do you live with that demon?
Mm-hmm.
How does it just become a companion that doesn't overwhelm you?
Yes. And this is like, to bring it back around to what you were saying about like whether it was difficult or scary to share that kind of stuff publicly, I've talked a lot on the tour about this distinction between what I see as like easy vulnerability for me, which when I gave my talk at EXO, there were some things I was sharing that I was a little scared about talking about. There, I was worried that people would think, you know, they'd judge me for being on government assistance or like, I don't know, there's a bunch of stuff. But actually, that was the stuff that elicited the strongest response, like the more vulnerable I was. But there was a lot of stuff that I grew up in a very hippie environment. Like, I went to schools that were very small and were based around concepts of community where, like, the student and teacher body would meet often and have these councils where we would pass a talking stick around and, like, have this structure, which is based on Native traditions from the region of Southern California that I grew up in. And that as a framework, especially as a young kid from, like, age 10 onward, maybe 7 onward, is wild and, like, the kind of thing it's easy to roll your eyes at when you're a teen, although I was super into it as a teen too, so, like, this kind of checks out. But it gave me a lot of tools that I think a lot of kids don't get. And so there are ways of being vulnerable that to me feel kind of easy and to other people look really unthinkably scary.
Yeah.
But then there are ways of being vulnerable that are beyond that for me. And so it's like a question of, am I pushing the communal sense of comfort in terms of, like, the average person who follows me on Instagram, or am I pushing my own boundaries of comfort? And so in my darker moments, it's like, oh, you're doing this project and, like, 90% of these entries are other people think you're being vulnerable, but I know you're not being really vulnerable.
Right.
And what's funny is that when I look at the entries that were really hard for me, I haven't drawn myself facing the viewer in any of them. I'm always turned away.
Did you notice that after the fact?
I noticed it on tour, actually, that someone had asked what my favorite entry was. And I talked a little bit about the fact that, like, people like, it's usually the funny or relatable ones that people pick. And the ones that are my favorite are the ones that are come from a place of sadness, because the point counterpoint structure of talking to the demon gave me some tools to be kinder to myself when I was grappling with those thoughts. And it's actually, I mean, as hokey as this might sound, like, it's become a script for me that if I'm dealing with difficult feelings, which I was often on the tour, you know, I was doing it alone, like, it was really grueling. And in the first month alone, like, I ended up, you know, just, like, crying one night, like, oh God, what am I, I'm so alone. And had this moment of thinking about that demon and thinking about him, like, holding my hand and saying, well, it's okay, like, we'll do it together. Like, we're doing this together.
That's so cute.
And I was lying there crying and then also laughing and being like, this is absurd, like, what?
Totally.
But it's kind of true. Like, I think that that structure is really helpful. And the book kind of was therapy for me. And it seems like it's kind of been like therapy for other people.
Yeah, totally.
And it's a tricky question, because I think this came up at the San Francisco stop, actually. And Rose Eveleth, who was there on the panel, spoke to this, which I thought was valuable, about the moment that we're in. And there's this sense of, like, if you just bare your soul and tell your most vulnerable innermost secrets, that is enough to change the narrative or to change the world. And she was saying, like, you know, it's not always. And also, those stories are very easily co-opted and commodified. And you have to be careful about how you're sharing and what you're sharing. And, like, I really resonated with that.
Yeah.
Because it's not sustainable to get that real all the time.
Yeah. I actually, as you were talking about this a little bit, I was like, I've gone through several phases in my professional, like, my public-facing professional life where I wasn't even remotely vulnerable in any way whatsoever for mm-hmm. a lot of safety reasons and 'cause I needed it to protect myself mentally through what was just a hellish time.
Yep.
And then I realized that that did a disservice to the public, because I had all these women who thought that I was invincible to harassment and abuse. And I was like, what the fuck? But then also, like, I was asked recently to do an event where they wanted to have conversations that were not the standard conversations you would always have. And the way they described it, I was like, so you're asking me to be vulnerable live streamed to a bunch of people and in front of this giant audience? Like, you don't know what you're asking. And I think it's unfair of you to ask that.
Yeah.
Like, our lines of vulnerability can be so powerful and so valuable. And sometimes I want to do that. And sometimes I don't. And sometimes it doesn't feel safe to do that. So what is, like, how do you navigate, like, the potential social benefit of it? The commodification of it, potentially, right? That's not a benefit. And, like, how scary that can be for your safety, for your well-being, for your mental progress, like, your mental health progress. Like, there's a lot tied up in being publicly vulnerable, even though it's so celebrated.
Yes. And so, I mean, it is powerful. And it creates those ties of gratitude that bind people together in the age of crowdfunding. Like, yeah. That's the thing that when I give of myself to people who follow me on the internet, they give back. You know, whether that's financially, whether it's logistically, whether it's, you know, by telling their friends, like, we want to help the people that we know. So it behooves us as online personalities to feel like a person who is knowable. And that's hard because you can't know somebody online. Even people you know super well in real life and you follow them on, you know, Instagram or whatever, like, that does not give you an accurate picture of what they are going through.
No.
And we're starting to know that. Yeah. But like, and it's the same as dealing with anxiety or imposter syndrome is like, as adults, we hypothetically intellectually understand that other people deal with imposter syndrome, but it's so hard to make the leap from like hypothetically understanding that other people go through that to recognizing that everyone at this 2,200 person event deals with it in some form.
Yeah.
And like, I just can't, it is so hard. I literally wrote a book about it and it's so hard for me to get over that and be like, you can't email Anita Sarkeesian. Like, you can't do that. She's important. And then you're like, snap out of it. Like, that's what people think about you. And you know that you're just a person.
Exactly.
And it's hard to say this because it's contradictory, just like your inner critic, right? On the one hand, you're like, nobody email me ever again. I'm going to live in my cave. Please leave me alone. And then on the other hand, you're like, I'm a person just like you. Please connect with me.
Yeah.
And what's the
balance of all of that?
It's right. How do you flag it online?
And how do you communicate that when you want something sometimes and not other times?
Yes.
Right.
And you don't want people to feel intimidated talking to you.
So our advice to our fans are do and don't email us.
Yes. Please. It's Schrodinger's fan mail.
Yeah.
Oh, man. It's really tricky. And like, I think there's a person here this weekend, Gretchen McCullough, who wrote an essay about what's it called? She calls it like an information discrepancy, where you've just seen somebody give a talk or you're familiar with their work and you want to go up and start a conversation with them or give them a compliment. And she wrote like a fantastic essay on sort of tactics and things to consider when you're bridging that divide.
Oh, I'd love to read that.
It's great. I retweeted it this morning. And it's just like, it's very smart and it addresses a thing that people encounter all the time, especially in communities like this, where they'll be like, you know, and then suddenly they freeze up and like don't know what to say. And it can be exhausting to do the labor of trying to make it comfortable for the other person.
Yeah.
To be like, hey, it's okay. Like, we're just people here.
And that's a hard thing to talk about because then you sound like an arrogant asshole who doesn't appreciate their fans.
Yeah.
So I'm really curious about this article because I have tension around that as well.
It's written from the perspective of academia a little more than it is like nerd culture, but I think it's still really applicable. Yeah. And it's a nice thing to have a name for.
Yeah.
Maybe this, again, is my like academic brain, but anytime someone's like parasocial relationship, I'm like, there's a term for
there's
that.
A word.
It makes I can a, understand it.
I feel like my entire career is predicated on like naming things, like
yes.
helping people name things.
Oh,
it's
man.
So powerful.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. We could talk for hours. I am dripping sweat.
It is so hot in this fucking airstream.
Like, I literally, my shirt is like suctioned onto my body now, which is a visual
is
that everybody really needed.
Sensual podcast hour. It is like a sauna, though, which makes it feel even more confessional that we're having like Swedish heart to heart.
We are.
Yeah.
Let's
we'll bring
do
some
it in
cedar
Sweden
boughs.
Next time. Yeah. Where can people learn about you and buy all of your stuff?
All of the things. My website is lucybellwood.com, which is LucyBellwoo.com. And I am Lou Bell Woo, LubellWoo on Twitter and Instagram, and possibly also Medium, bunch of places. You can find my store on my website. I have a Patreon, which is patreon.com/LucyBellwood. And I share a lot of stuff there about this kind of thing, including like recordings and conversations with people, but also essays like the one I mentioned about going viral and the finances of that. I try and do an annual financial report where I tell people exactly how much money I made or lost in a year, which has been helpful for folks as well to talk about that. So
awesome.
That's me.
Great.
On the internet.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me in this very hot container.
Yes. Next time, let's not do it in a sauna.
Agreed.
Bye.